Well, hi folks, Fred Reno here. Welcome back to the Fine Wine Confidential podcast, where I chronicle the fantastic story of Virginia wine growing and the dramatic increase in quality wines during the past 40 years. In the latest episode, number 32, I interview Mike Henney, longtime winemaker in Virginia, who has worked with some of the pioneers since beginning his career back in 1990. That includes Archie Smith with Meredith Vineyards, Shep Rouse at Mount Domain, Dennis Horton at Horton Vineyards, and since 2019 as the winemaker at Michael Schaap's Wine Works. Mike shares his perspective on Virginia wine with me over a bottle of white burgundy. Take a listen. Michael, welcome to my podcast, and thank you for joining me this morning.
Sure thing, Fred. Great to be here.
Well, the beginning is where I always start, and what I want to know is, what's your story? And I said this in the intro, how does someone who graduates from UVA after studying mechanical engineering and comparative literature find themselves with a career in winemaking? What's the background here?
Yeah, so I'd say maybe backing up a decade before that when, gosh, I think I was in the third or fourth grade, and I grew up in the suburbs of Northern Virginia. My dad worked on Capitol Hill. They had come down from Pennsylvania for government jobs. My grandparents, particularly my grandfather, he had a great interest in history and genealogy, and they were taking a trip to Germany to see kind of where part of our family was from. And they really wanted to take me along, and I was like so excited. I didn't know what Germany was, but it was like this crazy thing that I didn't know anything about. But for whatever reason, the decision was made, like, I think Michael's probably a little too young for it. He can go with you on the next trip. And it really just kind of like, it was kind of a big, I remember it being a big disappointment, but maybe it really kind of like stoked my hunger and that. So my grandparents get back, and they get my dad like this little souvenir bottle of German wine, and there was no wine in the house. I mean, there was, you know, maybe, Reuniti on Friday night or something. So, you know, we were kind of deep in the 70s in middle America. My dad kept it in his sock drawer, and I would go up when he wasn't there. I would like stare at it and kind of wonder what this stuff
like
was.
Like a souvenir or something.
Yeah. It was just like a souvenir bottle and had all the crazy lettering on it. And, one day when he wasn't home, like, I cracked it open. I took like a little sip, and it was like tart and bright. And then I put it back up and hope no one would notice. So that was my first taste of wine. So it, yeah.
What an amazing story.
Yeah.
And I bet you they were really happy when they found out you opened their bottle of wine.
I think that the thought of them for them, it was like a souvenir, like something that, wouldn't really be tasted. And for me, I was like, what is this stuff? What's going on in it? So, yeah.
Well, so now you're graduating from the University of Virginia. What was the first pathway into the wine industry?
As a kid, I was good at math and science, and it's kind of my parents' dream that I'd become an engineer, and I ended up in mechanical engineering at UVA. And, you know, I liked all that stuff, and it all kind of fit together nicely, and my grades were pretty good. But I also had this whole other side that I was obsessed by, like poetry and music, and I had a lot of friends who were, you know, kind of musicians and artists, and I was just so kind of torn between these two worlds. So I ended up breaking my mom's heart and dropping out of engineering school, and I ended up getting a degree in something useless called comparative literature, as far as getting a paycheck. Yeah, so I'm out of school, and I need a job, and I see that there's this winery who needs help during harvest, Montamine Cellars, and the cool part was I could ride my bike down there on Route 20. I could get down there in about 40 minutes, because my girlfriend at the time, she had a job out in Crozet, so she needed the car. So I'd ride down in the morning, and Shep Rouse was a winemaker there.
So Shep was there. Is this 1990?
This is 1990, yeah. So, so I'd go down, you know, we'd throw some boxes around, you know, grapes would come in. I had no idea what was going on. It was just fun. It was hard work. And we, of course, I had this very romantic view and we were making wine and I didn't really know what it meant, but that was my first harvest, 1990.
But so did you stay at Mount Domain at that point or?
Yeah. So, you know, I think how that played out. One day, we kind of finished cleaning stuff up. Shep, I remember he was kind of staying outside the tasting room, and he invited me over to taste with him. And I didn't know what tasting was. You know, I knew what drinking was, but I didn't know what tasting was. It was the first time I'd seen someone kind of like swirl the glass and take it in and make all the funny noises and, you know, think about it and listen to it. I was kind of hooked. I thought, yeah, I could taste some stuff, and there's some stuff going on. That really kind of thought me, made me think like, yeah, that's kind of a cool thing to do.
Well, did you start learning to make wine then under Shep? Or?
I didn't. At that point, really, the driving force of my life was get to Europe and have a shot at being a writer. So Wall had just come down. The other part of my family's from Central Europe. My grandma lied to me and said we're from Czechoslovakia. Ended up being the Ukraine, but the borders have shifted. So maybe we'll give her a break on that one. I ended up... I had a friend living in Berlin, a friend living in Prague. So I spent the next kind of 5 years bouncing around Central Europe. But each year I would come back to work harvest.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So tell me about Archie Smith. When were you involved at Meredith?
When I came back in 91 to work harvest, Shep had told me, like, there's this wild man up in Northern Virginia named Archie Smith. He's got a big farm. He probably needs some help. So from 91 through 95, I'd come back and work the harvest at Meredith.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was Archie like? I'm curious.
Yeah. So, you know, Archie was great. We had this kind of connection where we were both, I think we both felt like citizens of a Habsburg empire that no longer existed. So a big part of Archie. So, you know, he had gotten a PhD in philosophy from Oxford and, you know, he was like into Wittgenstein and this stuff, like kind of heavy hitting philosophers. He was also really into music. Like he loved the Rolling Stones. You know, he had decided to kind of give up the career as a professor to come back and help on the family farm. Yeah. It was my romantic version of like, here's like a gentleman farmer, like on his big estate. And the longer I worked there, maybe I saw some of the challenges of running a winery in Virginia.
Well, and we talked about this earlier when I first spoke with you, and I'm really curious. So you worked at Calvert Woodley at one point.
Yeah.
In D.C., Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
What year was that?
That would have been, when I stopped going back to the Czech Republic. I'd work at Calvert Woodley through the year. It was actually Archie's mom had, the Smiths had lived in D.C. So they started Meredith in 72, I believe. And I think they had lived in D.C. before then, and they were wine people. I think they did a lot of shopping. I can't remember when Calvert and Woodley kind of came together.
But, well, I remember, yeah, the merger at what point in time. But, boy, that must have been an interesting... Was Tom McNew there at the time?
Yeah, Tom McNew was there. So Mrs. Smith had said, you should go talk to Ed Sands, the owner, one of the owners of Calvert Woodley. And I did. And they said, yeah. Yeah, my wife, Natasha, she was in grad school at George Washington at the time.
Okay.
So we lived in D.C. and I could walk to Calvert Woodley. And I'd gone from this kind of like hands-on, making wine in Virginia, but... Not really knowing anything about the world of wine. Like I thought, like, you know, Virginia, we're making the greatest wines in the world. I had no idea. I quickly learned at Calvert Woodley.
Oh yeah, no, what a great selection. So now your path leads you to working yet with another pioneer, Dennis Horton. How did that all come together?
Yeah, so Calvert Woodley. It was such an amazing experience where, you know, you had your Thierry Theiss's and your Bobby Ketchers and your Alain Jugenets, and, you know, every day a rep would come in and, you know, you get to try 20 Burgundies. And I'd be like, oh, my God, what's going on here? And the people I work with, Tom New, Lilia Zenner, Alan Murphy, they were all super supportive. Really had some great mentors there. And we had this really neat opportunity. When you closed, part of the deal was you could choose one bottle of wine from the shelf. So every night, usually that'd be about three people closing together. So we'd each choose a bottle of wine, we'd brown bag it, and we'd blind taste it. And man, I love that, because there's maybe like two to three thousand really cool selections, and you'd be like, oh my gosh, is it New World? Is it Old World? What's the vintage? And that whole experience kind of really got me interested in the world of wine and the taste of wine. My heart was still in Virginia, so I still wanted to be on the production side. Mm-hmm. So Chris Pierman was at Naked Mountain at the time, which was kind of a highly regarded Virginia Chardonnay producer in the 90s. He'd come in and make some deliveries. So I got to know him, and I told him, like, man, I really want to get back out into production. And he said, I'll call Alan Kinney, who was a consultant at Horton. And I'll tell you, when the Horton 93 Viognier kind of hit the shelves, I remember, like, Tom's like, Mike, you gotta try this. This is really good. The thought at the time that something from Virginia could be made that could compete with something in Calvert Woodley, where you could choose from Burgundy, the Rhone, Tuscany, that there'd be even this tiniest of voices that would have something to say there. For that, I think it was kind of like, okay, they make wine in Virginia, the whites are okay, the reds suck. That's what it was. So that's what things were in 1990.
So then Dennis Horton, did you just call him?
No, I haven't met Dennis yet. So I took Alan out to lunch. So we went to a restaurant in Middleburg called the Fiddler's Green. He was also consulting at Piedmont at the time. So it was,
So that
was a little closer for me for DC. So I took him out to lunch. Yeah. He said, assistant winemaker, you know, at Hort just left. There might be an opportunity there. You're probably going to take a big pay cut, but think of it like grad school. And I was like, yeah, I'll think of it like grad school. Yeah. So I started Horton with Alan and the winemaker Graham Bell in 1997.
Oh yeah, so Graham Bell was there too. 1997. Wow. Tell me a little bit about working with Dennis Horton. That must have been fascinating.
I thought of Dennis as maybe kind of the Bobby Knight of Virginia wine, like just you know, very intense, driven. You know, I tell you, going from Meredith, which was kind of like a 70s era winery, to kind of Horton, where you know, built in the 90s, like there was beautiful new French oak barrels, there was nice equipment, there were good tanks. So it was really like an investment in both the vineyard and winery had been made that an entire magnitude above, you know, what I had seen before.
Wow. That was unbelievable. And, you know, Dennis is famous for saying that he probably planted more different grape varietals and ripped them out than anybody had ever planted before. What was his mind like? What was he always thinking?
So he originally wanted to go to Napa. He and Sharon took many trips out to Napa, and Dennis was like, yeah, you know, I think it's a really good time to get in. I think he had a really interesting combination of farmer and businessman mentality. He's like, all the infrastructure's there. And so he was really set on going to Napa. And Sharon's like, Dennis, you can go to Napa, but I'm not coming. So then he's like, well, I want to be with Sharon, so let's look around Virginia. So he, you know, did an exhaustive tour of what was going on with Virginia. But just as importantly, they spent, you know, weeks with like the vineyard manager at Phelps and Mondavi. And that's when they learned about open lyre being used on the Napa floor to achieve high quality reds and deal with some of the vigor. In the early 90s, I mean, there were a lot of issues, but, you know, kind of one of the big starting points was, what do we do with all the vigor? And Dennis was an important part in exploring an open lyre trellising system. That the idea there was, just the plant's going to have the vigor it has, we need to give it some room to grow. So, you know, there've been, you know, a lot of interesting experiments with everything in the vineyard in Virginia, but particularly vigor. Yeah.
Well, they also pioneered and bringing back Norton, the native Virginia grape.
Yeah.
What was it like working with Norton? Because that had to be a completely foreign varietal to you as well, right?
So, you know, Norton divides the winemaking waters unlike any other grape we grow in Virginia. So you either love it or you hate it. I'm on the love it end of the spectrum.
By the way, for the record, so am I.
Cool. I mean, do I want Norton to be the only thing we do in Virginia? No. But when the winemaker from Cheval Blanc was visiting Virginia, and he was working with RDV, and my best memories is seeing him when he came to the tasting room at Horton. You know, he wasn't so interested in our Cabernet Franc, but he really wanted to try our Norton. So just, you know, I think for him, like, how many regions in the world get an autochthonous variety that's from that region? You know, are there native grapes in Napa that are from there? Nope. So So I love Norton for that reason. I also love a challenge. Like I love trying to create a wine where people think, oh, it's Norton. I hate Norton or whatever. And I guess it brings up the contrary in me. I really want to make a beautiful Norton.
Well, speaking of Norton, what was really fun for me when I interviewed Shep Ross about a year ago for my podcast here, unsolicited, he opened a bottle of 20-year-old Norton that he had made down there at Rockbridge.
Uh-huh.
And I tried it, and I was like, oh, this is what happens when it ages.
Yeah.
It was just mellow. It was balanced. It reminded me, quite honestly, surprisingly, of some of the older Inglenook Cask Cabernets I used to get early in my career that would come from the 70s, or some of the old BV Private Reserve Cabernets. There was just this mellowness, this balance.
Yeah, I went,
that's it. That is really interesting, because that sort of aggressive young tone that you get in Norton early on, it was subsided.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow, this is really interesting.
Yeah. Well, I say with any wines we make in Virginia, whenever you try to imitate, you're always going to be two steps behind. You know, certainly, there's very important examples in the wine world, and we try to look at similarities between our region and elsewhere in the world. That's really important. But ultimately, what anyone needs to find anywhere in the world, but especially in Virginia as we mature, and we have done this. We are doing this more and more, but to find that unique voice, be it, you know, in the example of Norton, where it's a different grape, but I think perhaps more importantly, moving forward, what does a Monticello Cabernet Franc taste like? What does a Monticello Cabernet Franc from a certain vineyard with a certain soil taste like? And that's the way forward for us, is to more and more kind of find those unique voices. You know, we've now, not that we don't have further to go, but we've hit a certain level of proficiency in the vineyard and the winemaking where, yes, unfortunately, there are still flawed wines out there, but there is a sizable magnitude of folks in the vineyard, folks in the winery who are doing like top grade work, where there's not going to be any dumb flaws. There's not going to be any sloppy grape growing. There's not going to be any sloppy winemaking, and just being able to find that unique voice. So that's what I love. That's why I'm here.
Well, that is interesting, because that leads me to this question that I have. What do you see for the future of hybrids in wine growing here in Virginia? And I'll preface that by saying, what Ben Jordan said to me one day, he said, you know, when I came back here from California and back to my native Virginia, and I thought I had to make vinifera because that's what everybody makes. He said, then I learned that if you just make the wine the hybrid will give you, you can make some very compelling, interesting wine and not try to make it something that it's not. And you had alluded to that earlier. So what do you think about hybrid, the future? I mean, it's more sustainable in agriculture, is it not?
Yeah. So, you know, so the way I look at it is they're all hybrids. So Cabernet Sauvignon is a hybrid of what? Sauvignon Blanc and Cabernet Franc. It's just an accepted hybrid that's been grown for 400 or 500 years.
Well, that's brilliant. Yeah, that's weird. Absolutely. So, that's brilliant.
So lots of hybrids out there that are not acceptable for, you know, the highest quality wines that we're attempting to make. But you know, I think the work that Ben's alluding to and, say, Nate Walsh and a lot of folks out there is really to discover those hybrids and how to grow them and make them so that the thought isn't, you know, oh, this is a hybrid. It's just like, oh man, that's good. What is that? Yeah
just another grape, right?
Just another grape, with any grape ultimately just being a conduit for the voice of the land. Yeah.
So then you've been in the business for over 30 years. What have you seen yourself that is measurable or detectable with regard to climate change?
Yeah, so with climate change, the work with future generation hybrids and vineyard techniques where we can assure a clean, ripe, high quality crop with a lower or less on like fungicide and insecticide input is, yes, it's something that we're all working towards.
You got back to the old Mont de Maine facility by going to work for Michael Schaps, who is, what was that like, and what specifically were you brought in to do? What is your role? What are your responsibilities at Michael Schaps Wine Works?
Yeah, first harvest at Wine Works was 1990 when it was Mont de Maine, and my second harvest was 2019, so 30 years later. So left Horton in 2017, and spent a really interesting year working Ramosol, which is a project in Western Albemarle County. And then Michael had been generous enough to talk about, I was starting a consulting business, and he was very helpful with kind of what worked for him and what hadn't worked for him. He'd kind of had some changes there and was looking for a winemaker. Talked to Michael about the position. I talked to some of the previous winemakers, like Ben, kind of about how WineWorks worked, and also Joy Team. We had some really good conversations about if it seemed like it would be a good fit or not, and seemed like at Horton we made quite an array of wines from a bunch of different vineyards and a lot of different lots. So there were a lot of pieces to manage there, and at WineWorks there's even more pieces to manage.
Well, so, I was going to say, it's got to be really interesting, plus a challenge, because you get to work with different varietals, different fruit from different regions all over Virginia.
And I really love that, because I love being able to work, say, with Merlot from 10 to 15 different vineyards around the state, or work with 30 different plots of Cabernet Franc. So it's kind of my sneaky way of being able to, kind of explore these different sites and kind of learn what different characters come from them. And I love the kind of the logistic puzzles of kind of putting them all together and trying to make a unique, awesome wine with each one.
Well, now, and also because Michael's put his stake in the ground finally at Shenandoah Valley, that's got to be pretty exciting future for what you see happening in Shenandoah.
Yeah, so I guess I've been saying for a few years now, I think the big new thing in Virginia wine is not a new grape, it's not a new trick or gizmo, it's a new place, and it's the Shenandoah Valley. So yeah, there's with the combination of a lot of the limestone, you get the limestone on that side of the mountains, we're more granite based over on this side, third of the mountains. And plus just kind of the farming tradition in the valley, yeah, it makes that definitely a really exciting place to work. And there's a lot of neat work going on out there.
What is your biggest challenge daily at WineWorks that you're dealing with? What's the biggest challenge you face that you're always like, okay, this is it. I got to deal with this. I got to deal with this.
With the nature of our business there, I have no idea how many different sublots of wine we have. It's a lot, 300 or 400.
Yeah, how do you keep track of that?
So the decision making is pretty rapid fire. Certainly with Michael Swantwines, he he'll taste and retaste and retaste and retaste and retaste. Just the nature of our business, we need to make decisions quickly. So I guess the neat part there is, you know, usually every day I'm blind tasting 30 to 60 different wines.
Wow.
So for me, that's really the only way to learn what each piece is. It's I'll learn like small signatures on each one. Full disclosure, I'm not a super taster, so I wouldn't consider myself to be like super duper sensitive taster. But I listen really well, and I've been listening for a long time. So I find these kind of little signatures that kind of helps me.
Well, I'm curious about something here. That, as long as you've touched on this, are you a taster? And I'm going to categorize this, but is it the smell of the wine, or is it the taste of the wine that most influences you in your decision making?
It's smell and texture, I'd say, are really the two things. So I say with smell, it's more like kind of thinking about it, and with texture, it's more like a visceral feeling type of thing. Yeah.
Gotcha. Because I learned a long time ago, just to throw this into the pot, that if you hand somebody a glass of wine that has a wonderful aroma, they're predisposed to like the wine on the palate. If you hand somebody a glass of wine that is dumb and numb and doesn't really have much aroma, they're predisposed to not really enjoy the wine texturally or on their palate.
Yeah.
And that's just been my own personal experience. And so that has guided me. I'm more of a nose smell.
Yeah.
But then to your point, Michael, you have to have the texture. You really have got to feel that mouthfeel. Ultimately, in a blind tasting, I'll smell everything. But ultimately, I'll do the guzzle test.
Because
it's got to go down the gullet at some point.
Fred, you might have heard about the research group we have in Virginia.
Yeah, Winemakers Research Exchange.
And that was making me think back to a really cool trial that Matthew Fino did with Sauvignon Blanc, where, you know, there's all sorts of commercial yeast that you can use that kind of enhance aromas and kind of do this, that, and the other. So he did a really cool trial looking at some of the commercial yeast for, you know, aroma enhancement versus native or ambient fermentation. And that was such a cool trial because you smelled the commercial yeast. Yeah, you got that big showy flowery thing, but on the native yeast, it was just so interesting in a quieter kind of way. Probably like in a wine competition, probably boxwood and grapefruit and all this on the commercial yeast. But I think ultimately the more interesting wine was the ambient yeast, because it didn't have all that obvious kind of makeup on it. So you know, I think sometimes we have to be careful of some of the tools we have, where it makes more of like a makeup wine than what I would call like an honest or a true wine. And, you know, certainly with oak, we just have to be, you know, just as careful with that, where oak is a really important part, but you can easily go too far with it. And then maybe the wine's impressive, but maybe loses some honesty.
What's your favorite varietal, if you will? What's your favorite wine to make yourself?
My favorite wine is just always Cabernet Franc, and from a good site and a good vintage, especially freshly pressed Cabernet Franc, like that smell of kind of the warm juice going into the pan, just coming off of the skins, and these kind of aromas of, you know, rose petal and crushed red fruits. I just love that. For me, that's my little Burgundy moment. So when we're kind of pressing off Cabernet Franc, yeah.
What do you think of this white Burgundy we have here? Some Mercredi Blanc.
Yeah, it's doing well. So yeah, you could
dissect it for me.
Okay, so first of all, I love just like the purity of fruit. You know, this is just kind of an honest, true wine. The aromas coming off of it are so interesting, because they don't easily fit into like this is lilac or this is honeysuckle. It's something more subtle and ultimately interesting there. So my brain is going into kind of like citrusy, kind of bready, like fresh baked bread kind of smells. And, you know, while your brain's kind of thinking about that, when you get it in your mouth, there's just this kind of wonderful, not quite piercing, but like tight minerality, and it kind of feels like a voice to me. So you opened this up, I don't know, 30, 40 minutes ago?
Yeah, it's been about 40 minutes since it's been open, yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, gosh, this wine would be just so interesting through a week. Yeah.
Right. You know, I'm with you. In fact, that's my favorite way to taste new wine is have a glass, put the cork back in, put it in the refrigerator, don't gas it, don't do anything. Go back the next day, have another glass, and watch and follow it, especially when it's young.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been doing with Virginia wine for the last couple of years, to try to understand the – I love your terminology. I'm going to steal that. Understand the voice. I used to call it the footprint, but I'm liking the voice better. I like that terminology. It speaks to me. But what is it saying to me? What is this wine? That's the beauty of wine, isn't it? It's an art.
Yeah.
And to some degree, it could be a performing art on its own, can't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm so glad you've opened up a white Burgundy here, because certainly some of my career, some of my most highly regarded wines have been, say, some Viogniers or Petit Mansangs and things like that, but I have such a deep love for Burgundian style Chardonnays, and I think of Chardonnay as like the kind of the quiet hero of Virginia wine. So
I have to agree with you on that. I think it gets a bit overlooked in the fact that Virginia makes some very high quality, credible Chardonnays. And to your point you made earlier, as we start to learn about sites even more deeply and start to identify them, we're going to find more and more compelling Chardonnays that are representative of that particular site.
For sure, yeah.
You know, I mean, you know this, you're a winemaker, but Chardonnay is like the most neutral grape there is. You can shape it and form it, but if it comes from a really good site, you have to do a lot less of that, right?
Yeah. So I think, like you're talking about, with a being one of the most transparent grapes, it two different directions you can go to it. It easily can be lend itself to manipulation, be it, you know, kind of big oak or butter bombs and all that. But at the same time, it's probably the most clearest transmitter of terroir, just because it's like sing through me. You know, like I'm like, yeah, sing through me. I'm Chardonnay, like, yeah.
So, very, very cool. Well, I guess the biggest challenge here, what do you think about, is it possible that at some point we're going to identify more sites where we can grow credible Pinot Noir here in Virginia? And I'll put a plug in for my friends at Ankeeta Ridge, because right now they make Pinot Noir that, in my opinion, is high-quality Côte de Nuit Village quality wine.
Okay.
And I'm like, okay, how many sites are there out there we don't know about that can produce the potential for really interesting Pinot Noir? And you've had to have had this discussion with Michael Schaps, I would think. I mean, what do you think?
I'm 55 now, so I hope to get another 10 or 15 vintages, maybe some more in me, but that's going to have to be someone else's grail. For me, Cabernet Franc is our Pinot Noir. And so, if you look at some of the really interesting appellations in the Loire, for Cabernet Franc, for me, it's much more suited to our climate and can express sight just as well. So my heart will remain with Cabernet Franc.
Well, it's interesting you would say that, because some time ago I started buying a lot more Chinon and Borghi and wines from the Loire, because I really wanted to understand that footprint of Cabernet Franc and then how that related to Virginia. Because I see the differences here. I mean, the difference in a Cabernet Franc from central Virginia and even the Monticello AVA versus a Cabernet Franc from Shenandoah Valley. I mean, miles apart, structurally, texturally. So I can't even imagine as we get hone in on that even more and more, how much more interesting Cabernet Franc will be.
Yeah.
And continue to be.
Yeah. And I say, just like with the Loire, with Cabernet Franc, you can't fake it. We've all had underripe Loire Cabernet Franc that's really not such a great drink. And we've also had just, you know, wonderful expressions of Cabernet Franc from the Loire. And I say, with Cabernet Franc being such a pyrazine, you know, kind of green pepper driven variety, if it's not ripe, like if it's not ripe, you can't hide it. You can't blend it away. You can't oak it away. You can't, you know, we have all sorts of tricks available to us, but you can't hide it. And by the same token, when it's kind of ripe and beautiful, you also can't hide that. It's just, you know, it's just a really, really beautiful thing.
Well, Michael, on that note, I want to say thank you once again for coming to my studio here this morning, sharing a glass of white Burgundy and telling my audience your story.
That's great. It's been great being here.
Well, as you can see from my discussion with Mike, he is a very reflective individual and adds another perspective on the past and the future of Virginia wine growing. Speaking of past and future, that's a great segue for my next episode, number 33, in which I had the delight to share a bottle of white Burgundy with Tim and Peter Rosse, the sons of Gabriele Rosse. It was fun to talk with them about growing up with a famous father who had impacted Virginia wine growing during the past 45 years and how they intend to carry on that legacy. Stay tuned for that episode, and as always, thanks for being a listener. Hit that subscribe button, and if you have any questions or comments, send them to me at fred@finewineconfidential.com. See you on the other side. Music at Fine Wine Confidential podcast by Jason Shaw at audionautics.com from his copyrighted song Acoustic Shuffle under Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License. I hope you enjoyed the show.